Hello and welcome to the Belong Beyond podcast. My name is Circa Keane. I'm Projects Coordinator with Access Ballymun and I'm the host of this podcast. The Belong Beyond project is a collaboration between the Dublin City Libraries and Access Ballymun and is funded by the Dormant's Account Fund. This project is a series of conversations with artists and guests in each of the Dublin City Library branches. Over the past few months, I've been on a journey of discovery, visiting each of the Dublin City branches, meeting the staff that keep everything running, and learning the ins and outs of the library service. I've spoken to visual artists, historians, musicians, and storytellers about art, culture, heritage, and of course, libraries. Throughout the pandemic, we discovered and rediscovered the power of literature, music, art, and culture as sources of entertainment and well-being. Belong Beyond celebrates the power of art and culture, and the role of the libraries in supporting all of that. In the course of all of my conversations for this podcast, I've learned that art and culture influence our well-being in a wide variety of ways, from helping people discover a sense of belonging, finding a community, to supporting them in advocating for their communities, or exploring ways of expression, providing a sense of escapism in difficult times, or a way to celebrate the good times. The influence of art and culture is vast. The libraries, as free, accessible and welcoming spaces, are vital to accessing, discovering and exploring the arts and culture across Dublin City. I've enjoyed discovering the libraries and meeting all of my guests, and I'm delighted to be sharing these conversations with you all. So, on behalf of the Dublin City Libraries and Access Ballymun, I invite you to join us each week as we hear from the people who create art and culture for us, about how it feels and what it means to them. You'll find details of this podcast and all the other elements of the Belong Beyond project on the Dublin City Libraries and Access Ballymun websites, as well as across all of the social media channels. Bia Gielin. Each artist I interviewed was paired with one of the Dublin City Libraries. In this episode, Mancon McGann, paired with Kevin Street Library, and Owen de Vardoon, paired with Walkinstown Library.
My name is Mancon McGann and I'm a writer. For many years I was like a travel documentary maker because I'd spent about maybe seven years living in India and South America and Africa. Then I started making documentaries. Then I started writing books about my travels. And then the last few years I thought, no, I've been seeing amazing cultures all around the world and we have this such a rich culture here. So I'd love to try and present that. And so I've been writing books and doing like little theatrical productions based on that.
Great, and thank you very much for joining us. We're here in Kevin Street Library, in a really beautiful room surrounded by books. So it's a nice place to have a conversation about libraries, about your work, and see where we go.
Yeah, it's one of these amazing libraries that was an old library building that has entirely been converted and has like some really modern architectural themes and some still of the old attributes of it. Like that's slowly happening in Dublin library system. The old lovely Carnegie libraries, some of them are being now modernised really innovatively by archaeologists or architects. So this had do you remember when this one came out, it had a reading room and I'm in this like comfortable reading chair with a high back that you just lose yourself in.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And it's nice actually, the modern furniture and the old, you know, the old fireplaces behind us. So it's a really nice, a vibrant place for a conversation. I'm intrigued by the move from documentary to, creating theatrical productions. You haven't identified yourself as a playwright as such, but that is what you're doing. Can you tell us maybe a little bit about how you got from one to the other?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, when I was in my 20s, as I was saying, during those years, I was traveling in Africa and India and South America. And I saw, you know, the way when you're young, you just see so many things you want to tell the world. And you want to find a way to tell them. And so when it was my brother first came out with a camera in 1996 and put it on me, directed it for me for a TG Car program, and I started saying things I wanted about other cultures. But I realized it was so vague and so dreamy and new agey that no one was going to be interested in it. So after that, then I thought, I just need to learn how to communicate. And with TV, it requires a whole crew and someone's editing it. And there's just so much expense. And I thought, no, there's things I still want to say. Is there a more direct way of saying them? So then I thought, like, a book is just you writing a pencil, a piece of paper and some shelter. Mm-hmm. So that was maybe thinking, okay, I can build shelter. So I built this little house in the countryside and then I could just write. As I did that, then I realized, wait there, but maybe people aren't reading so much anymore. And I did like broadcasting, but I don't like TV. I've never had a TV. So then I got into radio. I started doing a lot of radio programs and radio, and then more recently radio podcasts. But then I thought, no, the way to communicate big stories is how we've been doing it long ago, and that is in ceremony and ritual. And the nearest thing we still have to in this world to that type of thing is theater. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want a three-act play. Like, I'm bored by conventional theater. But I thought if I could create little stages, little set pieces, little theatrical installations. So I started in the Project Art Center first. I did one called Gwaelga Tamagotchi, where I got 30 meters of raw Irish linen, and I stood in the middle of it, and I asked people to wind their way through the linen to find me in the middle, and I would give them a word to describe someone's character in Irish. Because I came across a dictionary published by Cushgame, which had 4,300 words just to describe someone's character. Just to describe someone's character in Irish. So, like, most of us have 12,000 words in our language. Shakespeare used 30,000 words in all of his plays. But Irish has 4,300 words to describe someone's character. So when you come across with an idea like that, you thought, what can I do? There was a book with the words in it, but it was stuck on shelves. I thought, if I create a little installation and give those words to people. So that's what, gave birth to these little installations that I'm doing.
And I think it might be an important thing to bring out in this conversation at the beginning, which is the Irish language is very important to your work, and it's very intrinsic to what you do. Have you always had Irish, or did you come to that at a later stage? Where has that kind of grow for the language come from?
Mm-hmm. So, like, I was brought up in Donnybrook in Dublin. So Pembroke Library was my library. And that meant once a week being walked down either by the babysitter or the au pair or my mum to the library. And obviously, that's Dublin 4. You know, that's Ballsbridge, Donnybrook. There's no Irish there. There's not much Irish, particularly in the 70s. Mm-hmm. But I only had Irish until I was 4 or 5. So because we lived in this little, we lived in a house that was like a revolutionary stronghold. My granny was this powerful Republican revolutionary, and her uncle was Theo O'Rahilly, who founded the Volunteers and mm-hmm. was very involved in Cunnan and Gaeilge. So the Irish was really important. And then they had another house down in West Kerry. And the library there was Dingle Library. And the amazing thing about Dingle Library is it had a bit of the mouldy bread that was fed to Kevin Barry,
okay.
The hunger striker. It was Kevin Barry, yeah, it was. It was force-fed to him, and someone kept the mouldy bread from the 1920s, and it's still there. As a child, it was amazing. And this little matchbox, this green bit of mould, which was the mould that was left over from the bread that was force-fed to Kevin Barry. So I would have spoken only Irish down in West Kerry, and inside the house in Donnybrook, mm-hmm. I would have spoken Irish, and then going to Pembroke Library, there was a tiny little shelf with Irish books.
Yep.
I was allowed to get books from there.
Okay, so it's been a lifelong passion, I suppose.
Yeah, it was my upbringing and my Maher Tanga, my mother tongue. Yep. But of course, like any child, you turn away from that. Mm-hmm. So I learned German and Spanish and French, and then a bit of Mandarin and Arabic, and just travelled the world and never spoke a word of Irish.
Mm-hmm.
Until it suddenly dawned on me, what am I doing? I'm hunting out other cultures, minority cultures around the world, and it just happens we have this amazingly rich culture that's connected to nature, mm-hmm. And connected to the other world and our mind. So I thought, let's try and find a way of first personally exploring it and then presenting it to people.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, you always do, the thing I do is I write a book. Like last year I had a project called Sea Tamagotchi, where I was looking at sea words. First you collect the words, you put them in a book, because a book is there forever.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a powerful medium. But then if I can find a way of presenting those two, you mix the two, of making a little show that puts the knowledge in the book out into the world.
Okay, so it's really, I suppose, as you said, enlivening the book, taking it down off the shelf and bringing it into people's lives and into their brains and their consciousness. You mentioned the importance of nature in, or the link with nature in Irish culture and the Irish language. How has that featured in, and the environment and nature featured in your work?
Mm-hmm. Like, you know, for a long time, I wasn't really focused on nature. I was focused on, I suppose, the beauty or the sights of other countries, in either my travel journalism or my documentaries. But in the last few years, it's become very hard not to be more aware of nature and, I suppose, the fragility of nature. So, like, for 20 years, I've lived on this little piece of land, this 10 acres in Westmeath, and I planted an oak forest about 20 years ago, and I'd have a load of different I keep bees, so I have a load of bee-friendly trees. I've had 4 beehives, and I've been growing vegetables. So I was always tuned into nature, but the idea of communicating about nature, I wouldn't have felt I was a nature writer or a nature communicator until the last few years, as particularly 2019 almost, but definitely the last few years, where people have thought, golly, the planet is actually in more of a dangerous situation than we thought, and it's up to all of us sort of to become more aware of this.
Mm-hmm.
I would have thought, God, I wonder, is there something that the things that I'm interested in, this, the Irish culture and Irish language, can they teach us something about landscape? And it just happened, the minute I asked that question, I started looking around me and thought, of course, like there's so many first beautiful, specific words for different types of weather patterns or different mm-hmm. types of stones or different types of lakes or different types of murmuring whispers of animals. And, you know, I called my book, well, 32 Words for Field, just, and I could have gone for 40 different words for field, from Raeann to Ingeltus to Bjorach to Branner to Cluain to Quiverin. So I realized, golly, actually, if we look at these elements, look at nature through the language, it actually opens up a whole new door. And then last year, as I was saying, I had this project called Sea Tamagotchi, looking at the sea world. And again, what came to me was, my God, I just went to Donegal and Galway and Mayo and asked fishermen, local fishermen, for words about the sea. And the richness of the knowledge of their understanding of the landscape, the weather patterns, the climatic shifts, the different winds appear and the different rocks and stones that appear both beneath the water but also on the land, made me realize these people are in touch, in tune with their landscape at such a profound mm-hmm. level, at a level that's almost like indigenous, you know, there's almost native or aboriginal. And I thought, golly, it's all there. The words are just there. So how can I communicate those? And it was then I thought, like, in some ways, there's nothing more powerful than a book, because all of the steps that happened to me in my life, all of the enlightenments and the jumps of realization were all through books. Mm-hmm. So although we're living in a fast world and one needs to think of new ways of presenting ideas, when I had those maybe 250 words, I had recordings of them all. I recorded all the fishermen. I thought, okay, now I'm going to pick out the most evocative words and make a book, but make the most beautiful book, make a handmade book that's made on top of the cliff in Achill Island on the coastline where I was collecting words. And luckily, there are, you know, we have big publishing houses in Ireland, but we still have individuals who are hand-making books. Mm-hmm. There's a little press there called Red Fox Press, and they made this gorgeous little book. So, yeah, it's about realizing what are the things we need to talk about now. The things we need to talk about are energy, nature. Also, this sort of new move towards female energy in the world, in politics, in the landscape. That is another key thing, I think. Let's try and talk about them in every way possible, by film, by play, by podcast, by books, and just by chatting.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose the more we talk about it, both obviously the kind of environmental understanding and awareness grows, but also there's something very, very alive about how you speak about people who are so rooted in the ground and in the earth and in the environment. There's so much knowledge and very old knowledge in that. And in many ways, I think what a lot of us learned through the pandemic is that the old knowledge, there's a reason it has survived and it has maintained. Mm-hmm. I'm struck by actually what you were saying about your piece with the linen. And then now Aran Agazim is another slow, kind of old traditional process. So I suppose to clarify, Aran Agazim is your current theatrical piece.
Yeah, it's like another theatrical installation.
Yes,
it's not quite a play. It's sort of like a cross between a play and a workshop or a lecture. And what it is I talk about the insights that the Irish language gives into the landscape, into our culture, into our own private psyche, and most especially into the other world. And I use them as metaphors for exploring these kind of abstract ideas. I use bread baking and butter churning.
Mm-hmm.
So I make up big vats of sourdough, and then I make up bread during the show, and I hand around a churn to the audience, and they churn butter, and then we eat the bread and the butter. And the reason, I mean, in some ways, it's just eating nice bread and butter, but actually, the bread, the flour, I know, I talk to people in the show about the fields, the actual fields that the flour came from. Some of it comes from Clocherhead or from Dunanny Farm, Clocherhead in County Louth. And we know what type of fields the workman family have been working for four generations from that word of Clocherhead. It's Clochach, it's stony. And then I tell them other flowers are from County Kilkenny. But then I also talk, the water is from Irish rivers. The salt that you put in to see, I use Achill sea salt. So mm-hmm. it's as elemental as you can get. The bread and the butter is linked into the language, linked into the land and the language. And then the language itself will reveal all of these words. Like I talk about the word coinine. Coinine means a tiny speck of flour, but also means a subatomic particle. You know, it also means the goosebumps you get at times when you feel that, like at times you feel where everything is so much more complex, so much more vast and interrelated. So you can take one word and go on journeys with it, which has been the power of words from the beginning of time.
And also then, if you think about bread and butter, they are some of the most fundamental things, and yet there is nothing better than good quality fresh bread and real Irish butter. You'd walk the earth for it at times, do you know? Yeah. So there's something very, speaking of goosebumps, I can kind of feel that.
It was proven in COVID. You know, the first thing was they went for loo roll and then bread. And the bread was sold out. And that's ridiculous. Anyone can make bread. And that's why during COVID, so many people went back to making bread, either soda bread or sourdough bread.
Yeah, I have to admit, I was a sourdough person myself. So I do know. And it's such a slow process and such a focused and intentional process that there is very much something about taking time and understanding what the process means, because you can't make sourdough without at the very least thinking about what it is that you're doing because it can work or it can go rather drastically wrong, as I unfortunately learned on many occasions.
And think about it, that sourdough. The sourdough is a mix of bacteria and enzymes and yeasts that form this symbiosis. But where they're arising from, they're in every single speck of grain, every speck of flour, they're on our bodies, they're in the air, they're in the water, and each of us have different forms. They arise out of our bodies like the Irish language. They're also, every country will have its own different species of bacteria and yeast, just like we have our own language. They're a perfect metaphor for how everything is rooted and everything is so much more complex. Like the wild yeast and bacteria are everywhere at all times. You can mix up flour and water in any part in the world. Within 3 days, the bacteria and yeast will have found those. That happened 10,000 years ago. It happened 6,000 years ago in Ireland. It happened 8,000 years ago in the Middle East. It's still happening today. So it gives us this sense. So yes, you can have old sourdough. Yes, you can have an old language. But yet they are first utterly relevant today and utterly alive still today. Mm-hmm. And they are connected into every single thing. The world is just so interrelated and complex.
It's actually amazing to hear you speak about that. There's such passion comes out of you when, you know, you're obviously very curious about the world and find learning and exploring really quite invigorating, if I can extrapolate that.
Yeah.
You mentioned the importance of books in kind of how you got to where you are. Mm-hmm. And when we spoke previously, you spoke about the importance of libraries. Can you maybe just tell us a little bit about your relationship with libraries?
Yeah. So like, I'm now 51 and I live in the countryside. I live on my 10 acres and I have no mortgage and I've never had a mortgage and I don't do much work. And I don't need to do much work because I don't have a mortgage. And I write books. Every 3 years I'd make a TG Car program for the last 25 years. So none of that brings in much money. You know, maybe every 3 years you get paid. But the reason I can do all that is to do with the Dublin library system. So I was like 18 or 19, decided I don't understand the world, went off traveling. And then eventually when you're 27, someone says, like your mum says, you're going to have to settle down and do something. So my brother came and, you know, gave me this job making a TV program. But I decided I don't want to do anything and I don't want to have to knuckle down, have a real job and have a mortgage and do all that. So I decided, okay, when I traveled, I saw people all around the world living by building houses out of what was around them, either stone or mud or grass or whatever, or thatch. So I thought, I'm going to do the same in Ireland. And in Ireland, I got land. My granny died and left me some 10 grand. So I got some 10 grand, 10 acres with the 10 grand in Westmeath. I thought, how am I going to build a house? And I thought, okay, around here, everyone was growing oats and barley. So I thought, I'll take their bales of straw, their bales after they'd made the bales of the oats and straw, and I would use that as my walls of my house. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how to build that house, but I just go first to Pembroke Library and I ask, I want a book on straw bale house building. And they find, there's one in the country, and they, you know, published in America, they find that for me. And I build a house, and then I decided I need electrics in the house, I need plumbing in the house. So Pembroke had nothing, and by then they weren't as good quick on the interlibrary loan at the time. So I go to Rathmines Library, and they had amazing DIY books on plumbing and on electricity. And so every step of the way that I was able to build my house, and then I wanted to plant my trees, and then I wanted to have a polytunnel and have vegetable gardens, I didn't know how to do any of those. I came from this school in Dublin, you know, that didn't teach anything useful. So it was the libraries that unlocked every one of those keys for me. That means that I now can live this life of real freedom, of no mortgage. Like, that's the power of learning. And that's why any oppressive force, the first thing they'll do is close down the libraries. This place any of these libraries blow our minds, you know. And then I started writing books maybe about 15 years ago. And for that, again, I was so penniless. I'd live on about $8,000 a year. And writing books, books about India and about South America and other places, Africa. But you need to have a load of research. You don't want to be cliched. So you need to read about 100 books or at least, 60 books on that country. Now, I wasn't going to buy those books. It just meant, again and again, going to Kevin Street Library, going to Rathmines, going to Pembroke Library, going to Ringsend Library, wherever it was, you'd cycle there rather than, now it's so quick, the interlibrary loan, but at the time you'd pick up a book. So all of my books, and every one of my books, there'd be books here on the shelves, my early travel books. The only acknowledgement is to the local library and the librarian in one of those, because they... Without those people, I wouldn't have been able to write the books. Without the first people, I wouldn't be able to build a house. Then without the second group, I wouldn't have been able to write those books. And then when I moved to Westmead, I was using the Westmead Library system too. So I had a Westmead Library card and a Dublin Library card, and I could play them off each other. I had it sorted.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're a borrower here in Kevin Street. You've mentioned Kevin Street. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And just to show that idea. So there was a time where you had two cards and I was, remember fines and all. That's all gone now. The whole system is entirely, as you know, nationalized. So I just have one card, can get me to any library in the whole country. Yeah. And I borrow a book from, I do a lot of traveling around Ireland. So I borrow a book from Kevin Street. I drop it up in Letterkenny and Donegal or something. And they just, no problem whatsoever. And like the reservation systems, I am constantly having about four or five books on reservation. They're always in whenever I come up to Dublin, the book is here for me, or if I go into Mullingar. Like how this library system has revolutionized itself in the last sort of 6 years, maximum 10 years, is just phenomenal.
It is really an amazing resource. And I suppose when you look at how every single piece of your career has a library in some way rooted in it, how does that feel now to have your books in the library and I suppose to be becoming part of that ecosystem for somebody else?
Yeah, it's really lovely. Like I'm constantly, when people are emailing me about my books, I just say, yeah, you'll get them in the library here. And now, authors get paid for when books are taken out. That's been going on maybe the last 10 years too. Mm-hmm. Which is a really gorgeous thing. So we don't need to think of feeling guilty, oh, we're not supporting the author. You are directly supporting the author. First, libraries buy shedloads of copies of your book because they wear. There's a lot of wear and tear, so they have to replace them. But even that, every time someone takes out a book, I get like a small payment. So it's just thinking, as you say, that I have received so much from this, from the library system in Ireland, and that now my books are beginning to that same open people's minds. Because the most gorgeous emails I get, and I get quite a few, oh, your book, the book 32 Words for Field about the Irish language, it changed my life or something, which is like so humbling to get, so humbling. Like I think back to those first New Age channeled books I would have read from America, these sort of spiritual books, which would have changed my life. Or even the age of 12, I took a book out from Pembroke Library about ghosts. And I was someone who always, I just knew there was more beyond the physical world. But you can't talk about that in school, they laughed. You can't talk about that with your friends. Your parents don't want to know about it. And I found a serious book in the adult section in Pembroke Library on ghosts. And suddenly I thought, I'm not crazy. I'm not mad. There's actually people writing books about this stuff. So, and any child, every child in the world has some interesting private thoughts of their own. They all have their own little passion. They're not telling everyone. And there's no room for these idiosyncrasies in the world. But once they get into one of these buildings, almost as this magical allure, this magnetism that'll attract down to the book that'll give them a wider parameter on that area of curiosity. It's magical.
And in many ways, I think the fact that it's written in a book and exists in something that is, I suppose, part of an institution, it almost allows permission for that idiosyncrasy to then flourish, and for that kind of area of curiosity or area of expertise maybe to grow from, I'm really obsessed with dinosaurs, or I'm sure that there's something to do with ghosts or spirituality, and then all of a sudden there's the scope for that to come out and really find purchase somewhere. You are working on a new book for young audiences.
So in autumn 2020, the book that like changed my life, that came out in the middle of COVID, this 32 Words for Fields, was a book that went viral and people started buying everywhere. And people started taking from libraries the minute their libraries reopened. They were just being churned out the door. And then in autumn 2021, I had a new book. I decided, okay, this book, 32 Words, was just sort of directed at adults. I want a book that's showing all of the words for nature to kids. So a heavily illustrated book. And there's an illustrator, Steve Dugan, who did the cover of 32 Words for Fields. Gill Books let him go wild. They gave him a huge format, like a 1 foot by 1 foot, 12 inches by 12 inches in format, and did these sort of woodcut type drawings of fierce animals. So it's a book, the book's title is, it's a long title. It's called Tree Dogs, Banshee Fingers, and Other Irish Words for Nature. And so, like, it really shows how the Irish language looks at nature like a child looks at nature. Mm-hmm. So let's say a bat, you know, the Irish, the English is bat, but in Irish it's skihon lahar, you know, leather wings, which is just so lovely. It's like if a kid saw a leather wing. Or a squirrel is tree dog, is basically madra crean. It's also irrua, but tree dog, because it looks like a little dog scampering up a tree. And then cat crean is a pine marten, a tree cat. Or how about a whale is meal moor, which is, meal is just a beast or a creature. So meal moor, big creature. And then a midge is meal tog, little creature.
Yeah.
So it's just like, I wanted these words. And the words themselves are potent, but then how do we make that alluring to kids? I could do a little stand-up show. If you mix, if you team up with an amazing illustrator, and if you find a publisher who'll give you those big formats, which is a headache for any library, because then they need to have big shelf space for the books. But that book came out in autumn 2021. And the book I'm working on now, it's a book about place. It's a book for adults. So if 32 Words for Field looked at the insights into our history, you know, our culture, our psyche that the Irish language gives, this next book is looking at those same things, the insights into our psyche, our culture, our history in the other world that we've confined from place in Ireland. So I'm so excited about that one. I've no idea what the title is going to be yet.
Great. And is that things like place names and what the how the name, I suppose, tells us what the place was about, or is there, what exactly do you mean by place?
Too. Yeah. So in 32 Words for Field, I think I had a chapter or two, or maybe three, about place names and how they are like these magical riddles, these koans that unlock other worlds. So no, the new book, it's looking at particular locations. So I was going, there's an amazing place in Limerick called Loch Gur. It's just a stone circle. It happens to be the biggest stone circle in Ireland. But when I started writing about that, I couldn't stop writing about that, because right beside Loch Gur is Cnochaigne, the hill of Aigne. Now, Aigne was a mother goddess. She's also light or beaming. And she's in the south because that's where the sun comes from, the south. And I just got lost in Aigne, because suddenly I realised, okay, Aigne is a goddess, but then all of the rivers in Ireland are named after goddesses too. Well, no, most of them. All of the rivers in Ireland are female, and most of them are named after goddesses. So Shannon is Shan Aigne, or Shannon, a goddess. Boyne is Boyne, or Boyne, another mother goddess. The Ban is a goddess. The Bandon is a goddess, and Bandia. So everything in the landscape is feminine and potent and goddess connected. So that's really what it is. So I look at places that are connected to Finn McCool and Cúchulainn, but the minute you go beneath those surface, there's some matriarchal female goddess there who was there before them. So that's what it is. I look at old roads, I look at bogs, I look at mountains, I look at killings, I look at the effect of the famine on land.
Okay.
So yeah, it's just all of the aspects. If we looked hard enough at the land, what could it teach us about, again, our past, our heritage, the other world, and our psyche?
And then I suppose, you know, with 32 Words for Field and this new book happening, I suppose, now, and I know obviously these books will have a long maybe genesis, but the fact that they're happening, they're coming out now when people are very aware, both environmentally, and that would have happened pre-COVID, but through the pandemic, we became much more aware of our locality and our connection to the spaces that we have around us, especially when, you know, we had 2, 5, 10K to play with. We became much more connected to our own place. Has that fed into that, or how did you find that experience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's been a key element. So like, we're here in Cavan Street Library surrounded by books, hundreds of books, thousands of books. So there is so much competition for books. And we also forget how many new books are published every week, like some ferocious amount. So my book, 32 Words for Field, that came out in 2020, would have just been another book. It would have been a book about the Irish language, and nobody's interested in, you know, no one was interested in books about the Irish language. So Gill Books, who understand their market very well, had published 5,000 copies. And they knew, okay, over maybe a year and a half, it might sell 5,000 copies. And like, they put those out, and all the bookshops were closed in September 2020 when the book came out. But it was sold out. The 5,000 copies went in about 3 days, even without bookshops being open. So then they republished, and they were sold out, republished like 10 or 12 times, until it sold like 35,000 copies in a year. Now, the only reason that happened, it didn't happen because of me, because I've had books out that have sold like 100 copies. Really, I've had Irish books that I know everyone who's bought copies of the book. It didn't happen because of the of anything else, of Gill Books, because, you know, they have so many books coming out. It didn't happen even thanks to the library system. It happened because suddenly you put a book about the Irish language out at a time where people feel frightened, disconnected, realizing suddenly that actually all the securities in their life are not secure. Mm-hmm. And suddenly they want to feel a rootedness, a connection to something greater and bigger. They want to fall back on what they knew, the cron, the fertile, the stout oars of their heritage and tradition. And my book was suddenly just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And so Gil had happened to drop a book out in the right place. Audience, the people just thought, this is the book we want. Without having read it, they were buying it, you know. So it wasn't that the book was good. And then the bookshops and the libraries just came and supported it and made sure there were books of copies of it everywhere whenever it was republished before it would sell out again. So the only reason I'm writing other books since then is because that book did well. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I would just be one of these other authors who had a book out and would have to be scrambling for another 12 years to find another publisher. But we're in a time where people want connection to something bigger. That's why we all started going sea swimming and growing vegetables, mm-hmm. and buying up seeds and walking, you know, and cycling, going to the woodlands. We want that connection. It's a really hopeful sign that it seems that COVID and maybe just the general rising vibration or consciousness of the world thought, we're in a pickle. Let's return back to what matters, mm-hmm. and let's remember the wisdoms that our ancestors had and even our grannies told us, and see, can we shift things around a bit and maybe build a new future based on some of those insights?
That's a very hopeful note. And we might actually stop it there on a note of hope for the future while kind of rooting ourselves in the past. Thank you very much for this conversation. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you and hear about all the work that you're doing. Thank you for joining us here in Kevin Street.
Oh, thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
My name is Ondi Bardoon. I am a traveller, also known as Mean Carey or Pavi, and I'm originally from Galway. I am a researcher, I'm an activist, and I'm someone who's incredibly passionately involved with the collection of folktales, stories, and those little murmurs and whispers from the community.
Great, thank you very much, and thank you for being here. We're here in Walkinstown Library, and we're going to have a chat about story collecting and folklore, and also about your book, Why the Moon Travels. But before we get into all of that, I'd like to ask you, I suppose, how you came to be doing what you're doing, to identify yourself as an activist and to be, you know, writing a book. What were the things that drew you to be where you are?
I suppose there's multiple threads there. One would be, I grew up in a home that is quite vibrantly involved with storytelling. And it's something that would travel to be quite, I suppose, strongly associated with and connected with. And I was blessed enough to grow up in a place called Clonatua, which is nearby, which is on the edge of Tuam, which is the highest population of travellers per capita in the country. And was surrounded my entire life with an amazing storyteller. So it just soaked into me. And I'm also a writer. And I was really kind of excited to discover the difference between a writer and an author is very little. It's all just about being published. Your practice remains the same. And when it comes to activism, how I actually became an activist, which is quite how most people become activists, is I headed an opinion and I shared it. Then suddenly, you're an activist. You know, because you have an opinion of wanting to change how either yourself or people around you are treated.
Yeah.
And I wish it would sound more kind of exciting and have a long journey, but something I was born into. And I was born into a distinct, I suppose, politicalised household. And my father was on the town council. We were very aware of other struggles and other minorities. And it came about, it wasn't just about travellers against the wider world and our context, about that the world can be full of injustices. It's not just ourselves. And we have a responsibility to ourselves and others, if we can, to help improve that journey.
So it's interesting hearing you say about it not being a long journey, when actually it's clearly been a lifelong journey. from, I suppose, being surrounded by stories and storytellers as a what sounds like a very organic and natural thing, to then create something and be, I suppose, taking that step from writer to author to be published and to be, I suppose, out in the public eye and in the public world as a storyteller and a writer.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to Traversific Tales, there's a tremendous amount of research on us, actually, from PhDs to anthropological kind of studies. And what we discovered is that while there's all this information about us, very little of it is from us. Mm. Like in 2020, it took for the first collection of folk tales from the community to actually be released by a community member, which I think sometimes can show the distance that we might be experiencing as communities that we sometimes don't always understand or appreciate. But yeah, and I think that most people are actually storytellers. They don't realise it. We just tell different types of stories. So my stories are really fixated on lore and mythology and connection and origin points and relationships. But if you've ever sat down on a Saturday morning and says, listen, guess what happened last night? Right? You are a storyteller.
Yeah.
And just sometimes we don't always appreciate those type of stories. But I find them of equal value because they just reflect a different part of life, a bit of part of our psyche and understanding and our connections. But stories, especially within the travel community, is a way to appreciate our lineage, our ancestors, and the way that the stories themselves are considered living. So every story is a story. It's not the story. And when we look at like the older recordings, things like the Ulster Cycle, like Cuchulainn and Maeve, they've become the versions rather than that was just when it was written down. So there's a sensitivity of, if I hear a story from you, and the vast majority of people at the time would have been kind of not, I suppose, not engaged in literacy, when I tell it to someone else, it's coming with my biases and my hopes and my passions and my worries, and I'm tweaking it because of how I understood it. And that's what stories are. They're living and they're alive. And when it came to actually writing them down, I tried to incorporate that oral storytelling as much as possible within the fabric of the tales that I first recorded them. Okay. And listened to myself back and kind of like really sat and listened to them. And one of the first things, because of a tale is in your head, it doesn't mean you're saying it. So like, because you've heard this tale so many times and for so many different versions, that it does take a little teasing out of like going, oh, that's what that was about. You know, I know I was trying to say, you know, you didn't get it, but also they're mutable. Like if I'm telling you a story of, to say, about a giant, and we're on the shore of Galway Bay, I'm going to incorporate the ocean. I'm not going to incorporate a desert. So there's a bit of fluidity there and movement. But I do think stories are alive because they're part of our fabric of who we are and where we came from. But also the reminder of what people have lost. Within the, I suppose, the wider concept of the Irish folklore and tradition, we have why the robin has a red chest and why the wren is king of all birds. What happened to our other origin points? What happened to the stories of why the mountains are there and where, you know, where the sea is born from that other communities are able to hold on to? It might be a part of, I suppose, colonisation, kind of intergenerational trauma. But as a community, the tribe community have been able to preserve a lot of those traditions and tellings and tales, and been further enhanced because we were nomadic, so we got to blend them far more than people who were in situ.
Mm. You mentioned the book. You write very beautifully at the beginning about the process and the care and intention you had in writing down the stories. Where did the collection process start and what was that like?
Oh, actually, I really started with an idea of an entirely different book because I thought, I'm a traveller, I can't just be writing about traveller things because like that's what travellers do. We have to live in our own little box. So I was started on a project that is almost completed now. And at the same time, the stories that kept coming up and I wanted to write all the time were the stories from my youth. Because they were reflected in different events and different experiences, and they're the ones that really wanted to be heard, and like trying to capture them, and in a way that was very honest and reflective of how I received them is very important. Because within the tradition, we usually have three core points. One is that if you receive a story, you have the responsibility to pass it on. The one of the worst things that can happen is this story can die on your lips because it could be the last lips that they could be upon. And the next one is no matter how fantastical it is, it's told as truthful. Because there was a sense of, because there is some truth in it. You know, it's someone's truth or is reflected of either a symbolic truth or an experience or understanding. So it is truthful. And the third would be, we always give reference to where it came from and where you received it. I think that's the difference between, especially becoming more aware, the difference between cultural appropriation and cultural appreciation is who benefits from it and who's connected by it. And that's where we change those points, that they're not just, I have a story to tell you, and it's one where they're going, this is where it came from, and this is how I received it, and this is the truth that it carries, and this is, you know, and this is kind of the, I suppose, bouquet of sense and sensory delights and understandings and lyricism that's all involved, that knits a tale more than just words, but into our sense of our own understanding of ourselves and the world around us.
it very much is, I suppose, an art form. I think that when you speak about it like that, it particularly around, I suppose, crediting where it has come from, makes me think of sessions where trad musicians would be saying, I got this tune from this person who got it from that person. And that's the history of it. And that's, you know, maybe how you're also seeing how the passing it on from one to the other has adapted or molded or changed kind of the original, mm-hmm. for want of a better word. But it is very much an art form. And it's something that's practiced.
Yeah, and it's living. And the illustrator is a Trevor artist, or an artist who happens to be a Trevor, I should say, Leanne McDonough. And I really wanted the illustrations to come also from a community member. And our process was really to kind of hear the stories. What are your interpretations of the stories? Like, what do you retell to your form? And the guidelines that we developed each other were very simple. One is that we wanted them to be in black and white, because people are allowed to colour in an image as much as they want with their own imaginations. Absolute freedom to recreate however she felt and had a sense of them, but also that they would be slightly wispy, which would be almost a reflection of the smoke around a campfire, which many of the stories have been told, trying to incorporate that kind of sensory, here's an experience, you know. And if you ever sat around a campfire and watched the flames flicker and the smoke rise, it's a wonderful experience. And then just like conjuring this experiences of storytelling as well, like it's sublime.
And it's a very warm book. And it's something that when reading it, I really found that despite the fact that I was reading it, I felt like the stories were being told to me rather than I was telling myself the stories. I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, that's how I was hoping for. Yeah. You know, to try to capture the language of it, because I think sometimes the way we speak is very different than how we write. Our styles develop very differently, and my writing style can be either overly friendly or very formal. But when I talk, I wander. I think that's part of the storytelling, that you actually want someone to have a conversation with you, even a limited one, because you can't really talk back to the book. But you want to feel an engagement, and that was even more important to me, because if you look at most of the material around Travers, we're actually either educating or explaining ourselves to settle people. I wanted something that, as myself as a child, I could find myself in. That's what this, all this natural incorporation of our language within the structures, because when I talk of homes, I usually would say a Kenya, and when I talk of you, I would say a Sublin, and they were naturally coming out. I didn't want to edit it away, and so I just, the idea of retelling my younger self the stories in a way I know I could connect with was very important. And then, as you can imagine, it's really exciting. Other people go, I feel that too.
And it is the use of the language, both the kind of the written language and then obviously the illustrated language and the communication, I suppose, rather than language, is incredibly, it really sucks you in. And so it does create that sense of, I suppose, something that is being given to you. And you were talking there about the three kind of, what is it that you call them now?
They're almost like rules.
The rules, yeah. That it is very much, it's very shared, these stories. And there's a responsibility in sharing them. How does it feel to be writing them down then, when obviously you're trying to create, and I think certainly the experience that I had, you very much succeeded in creating a almost spoken written book, which is a strange kind of concept, but that's what it feels like. But what does it feel like for you then in, I suppose, moving something from an oral tradition to a written tradition? Do you feel, how does that responsibility sit on your shoulders?
Yeah, but I always feel that it's very risky, because it is risky, because you don't want to strip away some of the beauty of it just so you can fit into the tight corners of a page. But it did come with consultation as well. Like, I didn't do it in isolation. Like some of the tales, I'm naming the dead and I'm mentioning the living, and you have to be sensitive about people, especially you're writing a book about people, you put them in the book, like you need to have sit down going, this is the story you're involved in and these are the other stories and how do you feel. But also there were stories I wanted to put into the book, because I had hundreds and I went through which ones we wanted to find like a common thread. But there was a story that was in my own family collection that I really wanted to put in that we knew that wasn't appropriate, but I could still talk about it, but people just weren't ready to have it kind and it settled into a page at the time. And that's the story of, and it's a repeating story. So the evidence of this same, I suppose, structured story comes back from the 1791 when it was first recorded. And I'll tell you in a minute what the story was, but when I had heard it as a child, just like how it's always told truthful, and because there is some truth to it, I wasn't sure, was this a repeating of an experience within the world, the wild world, or was someone understanding the story and applying it to the situation that they're in? So we have, I suppose, cultural rules around things like, I suppose, like either foraging or hunting. And one of the kind of, I suppose, rules, I don't like the word rules because it doesn't translate as rules, but like the one, the very strong guidelines, is that when you go hunting, you hunt only with one hound. Because the animal needs to have the chance to get away. So my grandmother's uncle, whose name was Jack, who ended up becoming known as Jack the Hare, went hunting with two hounds. And there was experience of the hare had been tired out, so he let loose the second hound, and it got the hare and tussled it into brambles. And he went into the brambles afterwards. And he came out with the experience that he had seen a woman with a wound in the brambles. And he had felt that the hare had been transformed into a woman. It left him in such a state that he was hospitalised for 12 years. Now, and so that's the experience in our own family. Now, his children or grandchildren are alive, so they thought, well, that's a bit too much now. But the story of a hare transforming into a woman after being wounded is very, kind of, it's very old in Irish legends and lore, and it repeatedly comes up. Like, some references are in Kerry, others in Cavan. So I was always really curious of, was that actually an experience that he had actually happened? Because to him, it was truthful. It was real anyways. But did it happen in a way that would be closer to my sense of truth? Or did he have an experience that he applied through the storytelling techniques and says, that's the rationale of what is after happening, and was so shocked. Either way, either made like mental psychosis or experience, it was real to him and it had a real impact. So it was really, growing up, I always knew that like stories actually have a real powerful and real and living impact on the world, not just on what we put out, but also how we receive them.
Yeah, and that's amazing. And it's amazing, I suppose, it's to kind of, as you were saying, to think, was it the story or the experience that kind of molded how it was presented? It's really interesting, actually, to hear you speak about truth in stories, because we've had a conversation with another storyteller as part of this project. And I asked her a question about why storytelling. And her response was to tell us a story, which was a great way of doing it. But it kind of, the root of it was that storytelling is a way of bringing a truth and to showing and giving people a truth that maybe in its barest form would be uncomfortable or difficult to take, but wrapped in a story, it's something that we can digest. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting to hear truth coming out through what you're saying as well.
Yeah, and I think as long as truth, and I suppose ways, especially younger minds, to navigate those spaces, understandings of like very complex and complicated, intricate experiences or understandings and situations, they also come with a lot of guidance. And like one of the tales we grew up with was that there's a plant called water hemlock that grows all along the river stems. And it's quite poisonous, and its effect is a very powerful, so it's paralytic. If people are exposed to it, your body becomes paralyzed. It's a horrendous way to leave the world. But we were told that even the pollen itself is quite poisonous. So our interpretation in reference to that plant is called angel breath, because the idea would be people would sleep beneath it, they get swept away by angels. So as a child, I knew that plant was incredibly dangerous. Rather than my father or my mother or someone saying, dangerous plant, keep away from it, like it's a horrendous way to go. You're told a story of, if you sleep or touch it, like you get burnt, or you sleep beneath it, you get swept away, which left a far more empowered narrative in my mind to go, even now I see that plant and go, keep away from that.
Because it's very visceral, yes, almost in a story. You know, yeah.
And would I have maintained and retained that information as a child if I hadn't been told it in a story? I don't know, because obviously I only heard it in a story, but my sense of self has said that it had fallen out of my head, you know, like 10 minutes later. So there is ways that we impart that knowledge, but also the idea of we're all part of an ancestor, either direct by bloodline or by community line or by your heart family, of all this knowledge and experiences. And in the last 50 or so years, we've become incredibly poor of translating that and passing it on. It's like, do you know who your great-great-grandmother was and who she loved and who her best friend was and what her wisdom was? And those type of things we've lost now. which means we are slowly becoming a little bit more disconnected from the experiences and trials and struggles and suffering that people went through to teach us how to do things better. Mm-hmm. So that we're now relearning all these stories and experiences again when people behind us have done that work for us. So rather than us actually kind of going, let me learn of this, let me understand this, let me grow from this, sometimes we start anew when we don't need to.
And actually, that's something that I think a lot of people discovered over the past couple of months, and we're coming on to years, plural now at this stage. But that slowing down and the kind of older practices and older, you know, like sourdough bread was kind of the obvious one that many people did. But in a kind of a shocked state, we all returned to the things that historically we knew somewhere within us, I think. And storytelling, to me, is one of the while all art forms are storytelling, and as you said, you know, regaling your housemate with the news of the night out from the night before is storytelling. But to me, it's something that is very rooted in us historically, and I think when I hear a storyteller tell tales, it connects me to an older version of myself that has already existed.
Yeah, and we'll continue to evolve and readapt in spaces. Like, one of my first experiences of moving to Dublin, it totally blew my mind, right? Being a pure culture from the West, is that I grew up with foraging. Like, foraging is very simple, it's very understandable. There's certain, like, you know about your environment and how to take and how not to overreap a space because you want the plant to come back. And there was a local course being run on foraging. I thought, oh, this sounds exciting. I want to know about the environment. It was so expensive. I realized, oh my God, has this like basic life skill now be something that like really kind of affluent people do? Because it's like, it was very in the, like, we are so wealthy, we don't need to forage, but we choose to, you know? Rather than, my point of view was kind of like, kind of going, that's where you get the berries to make the jam, you know, and different things like very basic things of like dandelion root tea, which people now call coffee because it's similar, but it's a root tea. Very ordinary, not very fancy. You know, it's kind of what you did because you needed to do and you survived and you knew what it would do for your body. But now it's all in vogue and it's like kind of got this like...
It's the hipster thing to be...
It's beyond hipster, please. And I was so shocked and I was like later kind of going, people are paying for this? And they're going, just like if you're blessed to have them, talk to your grandmother. Talk to your neighbours, it's free. Like, literally, foraging is mostly free. And, so I think that connection and that part of the world also comes with stories because people are explaining your actual environment. And I'm going to actually name them now. Like, myself and the partner, we've been together for 15 years. And I was shocked, beyond shocked, when he didn't know the difference of trees. He thought a tree was a tree. And I was like, oh, no, this is a willow tree and this is an alder tree and this is an oak tree. And he goes, oh, I know they're different, but, like, he had no interest in the name. I'm like, going, how do you not know a tree? You have been like, what has happened? The state of this country, the state of this education system.
And, what have you been doing all this time, looking at trees and not knowing they're different?
And I just, that some people invest in their spaces differently and see the different qualities and connections to the spaces. And I grew up in a kind of lineage and family there, 90% of our time would have been outside. Mm-hmm. While people from the wider community would spend increasing amount of time inside. So that's this connection from nature. And what's in the area has become very more severe. As for some people, also it becomes very kind of lacking empathy and connection to the environment. So I find like the natural world to be so honest. So people think it's this beautiful thing, and I kind of go, actually, I think the natural world around us is incredibly honest. The rain that falls on a trailer, the same rain that falls on a wagon, and I have seen the most beautiful meadows of blossoming flowers. I've also heard hares die screaming in valleys. So it has a sense of like, nature is very honest and equal at all times. Rather, we have all these theories and narratives on what we want and opinions of politicization. And sometimes we just need to return more, not to the past, but into who we really are, and stripping away the stories that other people have told us about ourselves and listening to the stories that are just constantly speaking to us as we are.
I wonder if, you know, sea swimming has kind of...
Oh, I love that idea. Sea swimming.
I know people are identifying themselves now as sea swimmers
or wild swimming. That's the one I'm thinking. I like that. What is the wildest?
It's wild.
And it's not in a chlorine bath.
Yeah,
oh my
exactly,
God.
Exactly. And it is amazing in some respects because the sea is the sea, no matter who you are. Mm-hmm. It'll throw you around, or it'll be the calmest, beautiful, most beautiful sea, and it doesn't care if it's, you know, the Vico Baths in Dalkey, or if it's Silver Strand in Galway, it is the same no matter who you are. And I wonder if there's something about that where people have people have literally thrown themselves into it over the past couple of years. Friends of mine who are, you know, dedicated weekly, almost daily sea swimmers, where before it was kind of a pleasant thing to do on your summer holidays, it's now almost rooted in something that they need to do in order to feel like themselves.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's something in that that people, I suppose, were, we've been so divorced from nature, I think particularly in this side of the country, that we're now that we had time to slow down, we're actually physically like flinging ourselves at it in the hopes
it's
that it
primal
kind of
water.
Gives us what we need.
Yeah, no, I know, I do think so. And like, what I always look at really interesting around is how we title experiences, because that would just be swimming to me.
Yeah.
And the idea of why we would call it sea swimming and why we want to communicate the idea that it's sea swimming, because it's different. But also, what stories and experiences have people had around them? Like, retouching and reconnecting with primal senses of our actual world is so powerful that it develops this huge movement of like going, we're sea swimmers. And rather than kind of going, like, how distant are we as a society to go, like, that is not fancy. But yeah, it feels fancy and it feels special and it feels powerfully important because we're not engaging with it. I think some things, especially with the stories within the trout community, is all about kind of going, like, you're not on top of a pyramid. We're not even a circle. We're a swirling vortex of ideas and thoughts and connections and beings that isn't really set on the page. Because sometimes you see that little graph, like man on top over here, humankind, and then you have the circle with all the animals. And you're kind of going, I think that's too simplistic. Like, someone's stirring that pot because needs are changing and species are becoming endangered and then they're not. And, you know, we're moving our environment. And I think we're a little bit more aware of that now. And people are a bit more aware of the green world, the living world. But we're not actually really doing that much about it. Like, you know, we say we are. I thought the change of the idea of, like, we're getting rid of plastic straws. Like, going, that's amazing. What else is plastic? You know, like, kind of like, but it was like, we're moving and going, really important. But sometimes I think that if we connect with the nature around us, we're far more likely to mind it rather than think we're minding it. Because you know your landscape, you know your land, you know, like, the home Kenya, because my parents, like, moved into a house, the name of it is Four Winds, because my mother worked out quite really that throughout the day, throughout the season, the winds actually approach the home from the four ways. So she decided at the end of that it was going to be called the Four Winds, because it was so, it wasn't just like number seven, you know, it was the idea of like going, what is the experience here? What do we have here? Like, how do we fit into the space? And because it's on a hill, and one of the experiences you feel mostly is that it's always windy, do you know? And I love draft anyways. The idea of people like wanting to put themselves in like warm little cubicles. It's like going, air should move. Like, do you know, we're not going to just fall away. But that, those connections, true stories and through our own stories, and understanding that even when we're silent, we are speaking to ourselves and we're projecting ideas with other people, and to try to resonate and anchor those in the stories and experiences people come behind us fills it with adventure, ideas we never thought about, wisdom we've yet to even fully undig, but also the opportunity to allow it to grow, because the truths that we find are just as important as the lies we tell ourselves. And having that mirror, however misty and foggy, to reflect on ourselves can be an incredibly powerful tool, not only for entertainment, not only for enjoyment, but to really test the fibre and fabric of your own sense of soul and who you want to be, and see how you're actually navigating yourself forward.
Mm-hmm.
This is very deep.
It is, but it's wonderful. I want to ask you about language specifically. Am I correct? It's Gammon Cant. Is that the correct title?
That would be its, I suppose, academically associated title.
Yes.
Although the old academic title would be Shelter.
Okay.
Because it was first recorded in the 1800s by a man called Charles J. Leyland, who was part of the academic movement and went on to people like Cúin Mhaire and Alistair McCluskey. But a lot of the work themselves is actually quite racist. People were surprised that we had a language, and they say, it's not language, now we're going to decide, it's slang. And okay. And then we pass a threshold of actually being a language. For instance, it is accepted and appreciated and supported and protected by the UNESCO. But when it comes to terms within the Irish state, they used to recognise it as an Irish language, but we don't have any additional resources. So that's kind of, there's that disconnect from it. It is a crypto-linguist form, which means that it was, and for instance, we only say it's secret to settle people, because we don't say it because we're talking it, you know? And I love the idea of it being secret as well, because, like, if you Google it, I can come across, like, these 11 books online on it, you know? So it's like, oh, this is the worst-kept secret. But people have used it over the years because it's changed in the social context and how we relate to each other for it to be used as a closed practice, how people aren't overly appreciated at times how it's shared. And I'm not of that opinion. I think, like, we need things need to allow it to grow and prosper and blossom, especially as the connections between our community and the wider community has always been symbiotic. We've always lived beside each other. But there's words you've spoken in our language you probably don't realise. Bior, fiend, bloke, gammy, moniker. They actually originate from our community, but also we have words that, like, come from yours. So, like, they're suddenly going, you can't say that, because it's like going, no, the history is different. But and it is a living language, and it's one that is actively spoken by many people, but it does come across with difficulties, mm-hmm. because people, like, for instance, if you're, like, most travellers don't get access to the high social spaces with the wider community. Like, we don't say we went out, we say we got in. So, for instance, and if you do have access to places, sometimes there's a hidden quota of one or two travellers being there, but not too many. So we, like, our social integration points aren't the strongest. Most travellers aren't in a position of direct influence. So if you're talking to someone, you're going to talk to them in their language, which they understand. Otherwise, are you insulting them? Are you alienating them? Are they going to be suspicious that you're talking about them? Which chances are you are? and how that changes how we interact with other people as well as ourselves, that we've got something that's so powerful and so beautiful that people become fearful of sharing it because it's protective. It's one of the few things that we've been able to hold, because the idea would be people would call our community travellers. Mm-hmm. Since 2001, traditional nomadism is illegal in this country. So you're called a traveller, but you're not allowed to travel. Transient bays are not in existence in the country in any meaningful form. And the place people live are called halting sites, with the idea that they stop them from moving. And the majority of halting sites you move into, you have to be homeless or guarantee you don't move. And if you leave one to go to another, there's complications. You've made yourself homeless in this journey and you don't get in. So they're not transient space for a nomadic community. They're places to literally to halt you. So that can come with a lot of difficulties of how we share our stories, mm-hmm. and how we share our language, but also how people hear us. I'm really fascinated around how, as a community, our communal language constructs are very circular, which means you can be in a room with five people and we're all talking to each other. When the room is wider community, we have this really Victorian, everyone takes this turn, and we fly and go in a circular fashion. And for the majority of travellers, that's not really how we engage each other. So we're considered a little bit rude at times. But also, the natural octave of the community is slightly higher because people will spend a lot of time outside with those ambient background noise. And then if you're in a situation where people don't feel socially strong, people go around in groups. So what happens? You see a group of people really loud chatting away, and people go, oh my God, it's frightful, rather than chances are they're feeling vulnerable, they're talking in a way they don't understand each other, and they don't have the spaces or the privileges, which is kind of odd to say, but most people don't get to those spaces. Like, we're still in 2021 actively campaigning to have travel culture and education incorporated within our education system. At the moment, it's going to be promoted, which isn't definable, because mm-hmm. that could be a poster on a wall, but to actually have it taught. And the idea of, like, we're trying to say, other people who are part of your people, who are part of the entire history of this country, our lineages and our histories and our adventures and misadventures have always been here. Why are we at the stage of having to go to legislation for us to be incorporated? And things like that, that's what stories do, that they show that we're actually not as distant or unusual or exciting. Because I think sometimes people have this, like, fascination with travellers and they're going, like, a boring life, do you know? Really do, you know? Like, blessed and exciting at times, but, like, please, no. I'm like, no. And so I do think tales have the ability to knit together that fabric of warmth and shelter that we can share with one another, but also reconnect us in far more real ways as people.
You have a glossary in mm-hmm. the book. What was the thought process behind kind of including the language and then also including the glossary?
Yeah. So the glossary came up in two ways. One is that, and also it's not a full glossary. There's loads of words in there that don't go into the glossary, because I decided along the way that I'm in spaces, especially the younger version of myself and family members, that I don't understand the narrative being used, the language being kind of used around me. And I thought, I'd like to share that experience. So rather than the dominant community understanding everything I'm saying, I want to show them that we share confusion. So sometimes you don't get what I'm trying to say, but travellers will, and that brings an extra layer. But I also want people to understand some of the story a little bit more, but also show the pride in it. Like, I love our language. I think our language is absolutely amazing. The fact that the state went through a structure of trying to literally destroy us. The 1968 itinerary report used the words, the final, I actually won't finish that now because it was obviously German connection, but the state decided to destroy the community and eradicate us. And the fact that anyone can speak our language is amazing. The fact that we are so resilient around our want and need to move is so important, because it's not just a practice. It's honestly a way of viewing the world and how we feel ourselves in the world. And nomadism and how our language has grown and changed is a human trait. Like, otherwise, we'd all be in the basin of Africa. And we've all moved. It's just that our community interprets that we were the people who were originally movers, and the people who come and left, and the people who continued to move. Mm-hmm. So including the language is a way to say this is something different, it's something that's valid, and something you may not... Like, a lot of people who didn't even come across it. Mm. Like, I came across a public house in Cork called Bures. I thought, is that a squelga for beer? No, it meant women. I was like, that's one of our words. Oh, that looks good now. And so it's there, it's used, but sometimes isn't always recognised of where it came from. Mm-hmm. You know, and so stories, especially stories that, because I tried to make the universal, because I know we kind of won with the Children's Books Award, kind of one of the within the youth categories, but I was trying to get the idea of young or old or any age, trying to make it as universal in concept and language as possible, because it is about understanding the ideas and concepts, but also having fun. And I hope if anyone has a story, that they're absolutely free to recreate, develop, grow, share it. Because it's really unusual, actually, when it first started off, I was contacted by a very prominent agent, because Skene Book, the publisher, is absolutely amazing. We interviewed each other. Like, they're like, rather than coming and going, I want to do a book, people hovel in. They're going, I want to do a book that's going to treat people right, that doesn't have a history of publishing kind of very questionable material, isn't going to get physically published by a business that also publishes questionably, that anyone involved is paid appropriately and, in ethical guidelines, And I was contacted by this agent, who was actually really interesting, quite fun, and has quite a lot of strong connections. And his opinion was stop saying they're traditional. They're great stories, but you can't fully copyright them. And that had never crossed my mind. The idea of people thought, they're quite unusual and they're quite Irish, but you could mold them into something else. Yeah, and I was like, we don't own stories. No. Mm. And that was totally devastating. And I think a lot of that also comes down to the idea of how our community traditionally understands the world. Like, we don't understand. Like, when my father came to us, and myself and my partner in 2011, we bought her home. And we're the first generation of people to be able to buy a home. And he did say, you're the first generation of my people to ever be in risk being homeless, because we could always self-accommodate. The idea that someone owning land doesn't really culturally make sense. You can mind, you protect it, you can grow it, you can have another, but you don't really own that. Mm. Like, what system decides? Because basically you had loads of people with the same opinion going, we're going to share this illusion of ownership. And then we've come into that kind of idea that you can own a land, but actually, in reality, how could we actually possess it that way? But we've lied to ourselves, because the story is strong enough. And some of our stories are about, actually, that's quite an odd thing to think that you actually could own that. And which can bring about points of conflict, but also points of really powerful, integration and connection and celebration of our differences, are things that make us stronger together rather than things that should make us strangers.
Mm. I think at that point we might move on to a story. You very generously said you'd read us a story. Thank you for sharing all of those thoughts with us and your processes with us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. This is actually it's a story that actually is quite close to my heart. It's a short story, but I think it's a very powerful story, because it shows you that sometimes the things around us that we overlook can have a lot more connection than we realize. The story is The Women Who Gather, which is the Bhuirtula Amuala Swirt. The first story I recall telling was a tale I had heard at school. I was about nine. I sat in a small wooden chair in the backyard and watched my father and a neighbour cut sods of soil in the garden in an attempt to dig out a foundation for a small shed that was never to be. The groove that marked that day still exists, and each time I see it, I am reminded of the sharing of stories. Now, the tale I had heard at school was about the Virgin Mary and the Christ child. They'd hid in a cave from some soldiers, and the kind spider weaved a web so thick about the entrance of the cave the soldiers did not venture in, deciding that no one had passed that way in many a year. I had only half heard it when I decided I was going to pass it on. I was small and a wisp of a subline, short on words and shy in company, but the anticipation of having a tale to tell filled my footsteps home with subtle joy and a loud excitement. I remember telling the story and feeling so very proud of it, feeling as tall as if I was standing on the chair rather than sitting on it. My father stood for a short time to listen to me, with his chin resting on the top of his hand that lay on the handle of the shovel. His grey eyes regarded me kindly until I finished. After a while, he returned to shoveling the soil aside and told me the tale of where spiders came from and why some still wear the red cords upon our wrist. Once there was an old woman who would travel the land carrying tightly woven willow baskets to gather the fallen bark or crab apple trees, wilting St. John's wort plants, any fresh beetroots that they could find. They plucked the flax that grew brazenly around the roadside and the wool that had snared on the thorns of brambles, hawthorn trees and firs. They dressed mostly in black, with edges of their garments that were lined in red, white and yellow. So some of the women had additional stripes on the dresses of different colours, one for each of their children living or departed. Their long hair was plaited in firm braids, and about their hips they wore small beady pockets embellished with medals, tokens and buttons. Every evening they would boil and dye the wool red in a big cast iron pot that rested in the campfire in the heart of the molly in which they lived. During the night they would continue to spin and weave the cords and render them red for young children. They would sing songs of hope and melodies of joy and choruses of sweet voices with minds of clear intent, stirring and carding and weaving thoughts and prayers into the cords for the young. At dusk they would gather, at night they would labour, and as dawn came they would rest peacefully in their bed. Now this is how it was for a very long time. However, as the years wore on, more and more children were born and welcomed into the world, and the old women who gathered began to struggle to keep the pace of their labours. They worked and worked and worked until the core to make the cords of red, which was the colour of blood and tones of deep fire and iron rust. Despite the struggle, they continued that they would keep weaving the cords, and one day they would weave a cord long enough to encircle the entire world so that no child would be out of the care of a loving blessing. Dawn and dusk, night and day blended into one, and still the work continued, and the old women who gathered forgot to sleep, to eat or to rest. Over time, their fingers that had once been kissed a soft pink with dye became darker and darker, some brown from the dust of the ashes, others black from the coal of the well-stocked fire that kept the boiling pot boiling. Still, the old women who gathered worked on. The molly, once filled with songs and dances of joy, became silent as they focused more and more upon their task. The sweat of their brows began to wash away the red from the cords, and they became like silken grey gossamer. In time, the cords became thinner and more delicate, just like filigree, but at their core they were maintained and held their strength. Still, the old women who gathered worked on. They grew thin and bony as they neither slumbered nor feasted, and they began to shrink. Some of the old women who gathered worked even one or two of their own fingers away, while others kept the gathering baskets so tightly strapped to their backs, never bothering to take them on between gathering, dyeing, weaving the cords. Their hearts remained warm, and in the task they remained hold and held to their focus. In time, the old women who gathered grew smaller and smaller, less of this world and more of another, until one day they looked little more than a bundling of fingers spinning and weaving with gathering baskets on their backs, adorned with the stripes and shading that once belonged to their dresses and beady pockets, and they had become the very first spiders. And even now they continue their work, spinning onwards and onwards across the very world. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Oh, no, thank you. Oh, thanks.
I want to thank my guests for joining me on the Belong Beyond podcast and the staff at the libraries for their warm welcome. The Belong Beyond project is a collaboration between the Dublin City Libraries and Access Ballymun and is funded by the Dormant Accounts Fund. You'll find details of this podcast and all the other elements of the Belong Beyond project on the Dublin City Libraries and Access Ballymun websites, as well as across our social media channels. Thank you. A full list of podcast guests is available on the Dublin City Libraries and Access Ballymun websites. This podcast was recorded by Clodagh Mooney Duggan and Jerry Kellett, edited by Stephen Crawley, sound design by Derek Conaghy.